This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
That's right. That's me, Rick Moore, rocking it out here in the WNRN studios today. The telephone is already ringing, and we haven't even told you who our guests are and what our topic is about today. And if you're not calling about that, then please hang up so our phone lines can be served for our hour of studio time today. Special shout out to the folks in Lovingston listening on 94.7. Hope everyone is feeling safe and feeling healthy, and if you're not, we'll do our best to make you feel better by noon. A shout out to Blue Ridge Graphics for supporting us during the hour. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street here in Charlottesville, serving customers with t-shirts, sportswear, and professional graphic design since 1979. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and at brgtshirts.com. All right, we're going to jump right into things today because we got a lot of stuff that we will never fit into the hour. But, you know, what the heck? Maybe Les Temps Perdue will concede, just like John McCain did. Our guest today, Jim Sofka. Jim, how are you?
Just fine, Rick. Happy New Year.
And thank you, sir, to you as well. Jim is an adjunct faculty member at Federal Executive Institute, specialty of European politics and international relations. Previously did Department of Politics at UVA, correct?
That's right.
And Pete Ronayne.
Good morning, Rick, and Happy New Year as well.
Thank you, sir. I've never felt so much special, just love.
You're feeling the love.
in the studio today.
Well, we resolved to be nicer to you this year.
Yeah, politics does that to everybody.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's all the politics stuff.
Oh, well. Yay! Pete is the dean of faculty at the Federal Executive Institute and also an adjunct professor at UVA, specialty on contemporary politics, public service, global affairs, and leadership.
Yes, sir.
I would think that that would make you a nicer, smarter member, but we invited you anyway.
Kinder, gentler.
Yes. What is the FEI? What is the Federal Executive Institute?
Oh, we should do a show on that sometime.
We should, because you know, now that we reach out to Harrisonburg and Richmond and Lexington,
you can demystify. The Federal Executive Institute is a an organization that works to improve the leadership skills of public servants, mostly in the federal sector, in the two top tiers of those leadership ranks. And they are, for the most part, not political appointees. They come down and spend time in Charlottesville to go back and be more effective in their various agencies. They are public servants.
So you're smartering them, making them much smarter.
Well, we're working with them so they can better fulfill their constitutional duties. And
can I take a class?
You could come over and sit in sometime.
Yeah, really? Because I just want to get by. It's a gated community, and I just want to be able to drive up the driveway.
Yeah, I could manage that. It might be a security risk, but we'll do that.
We'll
have to vet you. We'll talk about that later.
Even my mother would agree to that. All right, we're going to jump right into things. Today's topic is current politics, mostly national. We might touch a little bit on some international issues, but mostly we're going to talk about the new Obama cabinet. I'm sure that a few little conversation about the Illinois seat in terms of the Senate and the governor, and then as well in Minnesota, because there are two Senate seats currently empty in the federal Senate. And then there are some other issues that we'll jump into. But let's start at the top. The Obama cabinet. Obama takes... is it 10 days now, 9 days now before the inauguration?
Nine
days left of the Bush administration and before the Obama folks jump in.
That's right. Bush took his last flight on Air Force One yesterday to dedicate an aircraft carrier for his father.
Well, it seems that one of my concerns or my complaints is that the Obama folks... Barack Obama ran under this whole concept of change, and hope. Correct?
That was the trademark, yes.
And yet, it seems as though a wide number of these cabinet seats and other major positions that he has selected people to fill, their background has a lot to do with the Clinton administration, has a lot to do with their former work for years within, I guess, within the Beltway, as it's called. And they don't really seem to be new and potentially different mindset sort of folks. Am I wrong on that?
Well, I mean, certainly there's a lot of people who came out of the Clinton administration, and that's logical to an extent, because you had an 8-year presidency. Clinton sort of stacked a deep bench with fairly young people, people at that point who were sort of rising to the mid-ranks of his government, who are now, of course, even more experienced. So it's logical that Obama would look to them to seed his administration. I don't think that most people are too surprised. Previous presidents have done that as well. What is interesting is the degree to which he's built an economic team principally that are all disciples of Robert Rubin, who was Clinton's Treasury Secretary in his second term. And so there is a continuation there. I think that's both in terms of their experience, the training that they received in the Clinton Treasury Department, but there's also a political signal, I think, to reach back to Clinton's economic message, which reminds people of when things were last really good, which was the late 1990s. Clinton's economic proposal still continues to draw high praise. So I think by sort of showing the continuation with Clinton, at least in the economic realm, Obama is attempting to reassure people and reach back to that rather wistful memory of when the economy was in much better shape than today.
Yeah, I think that's a key point, particularly on the economic team, that Jim's exactly right. People remember, and people do remember, that the Clinton economics worked pretty well. Now, to what degree does any administration get to claim credit or blame for the economic record during their tenure? You know, that's another show and another debate. But by all accounts, their team of economic technocrats performed extremely well. And Obama is reaching back to Clinton administration officials for a very pragmatic reason as well, which Jim alluded to, not just in the economic realm, but for their experience. I mean, one of the mistakes that the Clinton administration did make way back when, early on, was not having enough experienced hands with them. And so they had a lot of on-the-job training, and some of their experience really came from the School of Hard Knocks early on, and the administration was not as successful as they could have been. So drawing back on that experience, and I think, frankly, Obama learned as well from the previous Democratic administration, the Carter administration,
yes,
who brought in way too many locals, way too many people who were outside the Beltway. And it's one thing to campaign on change. It's another thing to be able to implement it. And you've got to have experienced hands who know how influence and the levers of power work in Washington. And that is clearly part of Obama's strategy. And it starts with picking Biden as VP, somebody who can help navigate his agenda of change through Washington, because the expectations are so high. The promise of change is so big. And to walk in there with a bunch of rookie politicians who might be personally loyal to him but do not have experience in navigating legislation through Washington, it would be disastrous within 2 months. So he's trading off a little bit of the change glow to make it effective. And I think that's part of his pragmatics.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things with Obama that's interesting is his constituency is really federal politics, not state politics. I mean, Pete's exactly right. Clinton brought with him a lot of his Arkansas cronies. Carter brought some of his Georgia people. Reagan in 81 brought his so-called California mafia, Cap Weinberger being and Ed Meese being two of the principal ones. Obama doesn't have that. His time in Illinois politics was extremely short. And so he's thinking on a much broader stage than a former governor or even a short-term senator who was really focused still on his home state. And that's one of the reasons I think why he's reached into the national talent pool that Clinton had built, especially by the end of his presidency.
Well, that still leads to my question about how do you trade knowledge for change? Because I think that almost everyone, regardless of your age, regardless of your ethnic background, your job, has a hard time changing routine. And the older that you are, the more experience you have in your job, it seems as though that leads you to have a deeper routine to get out of. So how does bringing in someone who had a job 8 to 16 years ago, how do you tell them and how do you show them and how do you trust them to provide the change that you have been promising?
Well, I think first and foremost, I mean, this is almost the structure of government, but Obama will be the president, and he will set the course. And he's a smart individual. He'll be engaged on the issues, and he will give sort of commander's intent, as they talk about in the military. This is the direction that he wants to go, and his appointed cabinet, et cetera, will be responsible for carrying that out, and they'll do that. Now, I think how you take older hands and their experience, and Rick, you're right, that you get into a certain groove, you have a certain perspective hard to get out of, but the times are different. Crisis requires some change. The economic times, the geopolitical landscape, et cetera, is going to demand a lot from these people and require them to think differently. And whether it will work or not, of course, remains to be seen, but Jim and I were talking about before, and many people have made lots of reference to, you know, Obama's Lincoln perspective and Lincoln approach, and namely the team of rivals approach to things based on the book about Lincoln's cabinet by Doris Kearns Goodwin, in which, you know, Lincoln consciously chooses people with different perspectives, people whose loyalty is not to him per se. And then it's up to the president in that case, Lincoln and now Obama, to sift through the differing perspectives and to find the best course. So it ultimately will fall to him to make sure that that mantra of change becomes reality.
I think that Pete's exactly right. And I think beyond that, when you talk about change, I don't know if Obama wants a great deal of change at his cabinet level. I mean, Obama has what he's demonstrated is actually a fundamental conservatism. And we just talked about this earlier with Clinton. He's reaching back. He wants to show people that he's not a radical. He's not coming in with a completely new agenda. He's the change himself in terms of what he and his biography represents, first African-American president, his rhetoric, his tone that he wants to set in his government. But at the level of operations, his economic operation team, and even his national security team, I think he's actually not interested in rocking the boat radically, but demonstrating continuity with the past, as, for example, Clinton was as well. Clinton's second-term economic policy but had a lot of Eisenhower to it in terms of paying off the debt, tight money economics. And so I'm not sure that Obama wants to project change at all levels of the government. He wants competency from his team, and he'll take care of change himself through his message in the Oval Office. I mean, it's a different take on Obama, I think, than a lot of people have.
And Jim reminds us that what the president has to do, what President-elect Obama is facing, is he has to govern. He has to govern successfully, and that does require shifting modes significantly from campaigning. They are two different things. Whether a Republican wins or a Democrat wins, you campaign one way, but then ultimately you have to govern. And Obama has talked about change, but I think an equal message that we forget at our peril is changing the tone, is the bipartisan thing and wanting to be effective. And I think that is reflected in his picks. I think success for President-elect Obama in terms of his cabinet meant really upsetting two groups. And he wouldn't phrase it this way, but I think this is one way of thinking about it. He had to upset liberals. He needed to give them something to complain about, meaning, wait a minute, we thought you were this pseudo-radical. We thought you were out of the Mother Jones playbook, and you were really going to shake things up. But he really never was that candidate.
No.
People project their hopes onto him from a much more liberal agenda. So he needed to give liberals something to complain about to succeed with his cabinet. And he had to give conservatives something to complain about, which is not enough to complain about. So conservatives are upset that he didn't turn out to be this boogeyman radical liberal with all these, you know, ultra-left appointees. They've been rather muted. They've had very little to pick through to really latch onto. In fact, I would argue that Al Franken's going to be a bigger enemy of the far right than anybody else. In terms of the actual Obama cabinet, they haven't had a lot to really go off on. I mean, you have people like Rush Limbaugh even sort of toning it down and talking about Hillary Clinton, for example, as really a rather savvy pick. He doesn't like her, but he understands the politics and the thinking behind it. So I think he has upset liberals, and he's upset conservatives in the right way that he wants to, and it's reflected in the composition
and
of his
cabinet. And that's been the long-term phrase about you must be doing something right if you've upset both sides. I mean, that goes back to...
I think so.
That, you know, that is a judge, yep. Correct? That's what's often spoken of in the courtroom.
Yeah, and that's harder to do than people think, actually. It's much easier to lean towards one group, and he's been... You know, right down the middle, for the most part.
Yeah, remember the old Clinton strategy of triangulation, of sort of reaching for the center, the third way of the 1990s? Obama has done it, and he's done it actually in a way that Pete's absolutely correct, that Republicans have been stunned by. He offered tax rebates, which is something, of course, that Republicans were focusing on as part of a stimulus package, without having to be pushed to it. No one came in and actually told Obama that, you know, you have to do this or it's a deal breaker. He proposed it sort of on his own. And a lot of Republicans were stunned that Obama would even include that as part of his economic thinking before it hits the House and Senate for debate. And it upset a lot of traditional Democrats in the House, such as Barney Frank, Nancy Pelosi, who have sort of looked for a little bit more of a larger government policy, more traditional Democratic politics. And I think that what Obama is doing is signaling that he is not going to be completely the pawn of traditional Democratic constituencies in the House. And his outreach to Republicans, especially in his national security team, is a way to provide reassurance. The campaign is over. We've talked change. We've talked hope. Things are bad. Now we're going to focus on competency, and we're not going to radically rock the boat.
Mm-hmm. All right, 11:16 here on the Wake Up Call with our the show's political geeks. Jim Ronayne and, excuse me, Pete Ronayne and Jim Stofka.
We're making sort of an amalgam of ourselves.
Well, that's true.
It's a bipartisan, yes, reflective of the tone.
We think alike, but not that much.
We are talking about current politics in the United States. President-elect Obama's cabinet and some of the selections. We will be getting into the Minnesota and Illinois Senate seats and some other issues. Feel free to bring up your question, your concern, your issue, 979-0919. 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Now may be a good time to give you the weather for the day. Markets of Tiger Fuel forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Partly sunny today, highs in the mid-40s. Partly cloudy tonight, lows 25 to 30. Mostly sunny tomorrow, highs 40 to 45. And even a little warmer in Lynchburg and Richmond. Right now, clouds across the listening area, 42 in Lynchburg, 45 in the Valley, 47 in Richmond, 43 in Charlottesville.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
And let me thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for being with us today. Blue Ridge has winter clothing from Patagonia, Mountain Hardware, The North Face, as well as trail shoes from Montrell, Merrill, La Sportiva, and Vass. The Blue Ridge staff has over 30 years of experience in keeping you warm and dry in any weather. You'll find Blue Ridge Mountain Sports in the Barracks Road Shopping Center here in Charlottesville. They're at Wintergreen in Richmond or online, brms.com. All right, guys, we've been talking about the Obama sort of mindset, and as far as the cabinet goes, are there going to be any simple slam dunk confirmations or any expected slam dunk confirmations who are instead going to face a tough time?
I think so. I mean, as by tradition, the opposition party almost always picks somebody who becomes their lightning rod because they want to go after an appointee to demonstrate their power. I think in this time around, it's going to be Eric Holder, who President-elect Obama has nominated to be attorney general.
And what's his background?
His background, he's a career Justice Department official, now in private law practice. The reason why a lot of Republicans are going after him, besides a sort of general mindset, he's been very much associated with civil rights law, and a number of Republicans have been concerned about where he may take the Justice Department in that field, and to a lesser extent, some national security intelligence law. But the real issue that they have with Holder is his role in the Clinton pardon saga. If you remember, when Clinton was out the door at the end of 2000, he put forward a number of controversial pardons, most notably a former and then a fugitive financier, Mark Rich. and Holder was involved in this in the Justice Department. Now, he certainly didn't come up with the idea of the pardon. He worked on it. He justified it. And it was something that even a number of Democrats criticized. It wasn't Clinton's most politically adept move, especially out the door. And Republicans sort of want to make him pay for this. They want to bring up the idea of Clinton's approach to the Justice Department, some controversial decisions he made. But, I mean, in theory, everyone that Obama puts forward should be confirmed, given the fact that he has wide majorities, both in the House and in the Senate. And so there shouldn't be a fight that actually goes down in flames. I think Holder will be confirmed at the end of the day. But I think that the most bruising fight we're going to see is going to be that attorney general slot, because it's been politicized and that attorney general slot's been an issue. I mean, certainly there was the case. Even in the Bush years, Gonzalez, when he left, one of the reasons why Bush chose Mukasey to succeed him was because he was sort of apolitical and someone who wouldn't be seen as politicizing the Justice Department. So that agency has a history of attracting some criticism in recent years, but Holder's role in the Clinton pardon saga is, I think, why he's going to become the major lightning rod for Republican criticism and some Democratic criticism as well.
Yeah, and on Holder, too, I think it was in the D.C. Gun case. He helped present the argument that that constitutionally that our right to bear arms is a collective right, not an individual right. And that obviously is sort of a lightning rod in particular for conservative groups. So Jim's right. Holder does appear to be not the sacrificial lamb, but the one who will most likely receive criticism, but get through the process. When you have people like Karl Rove and others going on TV saying, you know, he's very talented. He'll certainly be confirmed. And there is this issue. I mean, they're sort of soft pedaling, but they're putting it out there in terms of giving people the reason to question that. I think Leon Panetta at CIA, it'll be an interesting. I think he'll make it through, but he'll be perhaps subject to some criticism as well. Maybe not as fiercely or ferociously as Holder, but simply for his lack of intelligence experience. So they're gonna trot him out there and I think ask him some tough questions about being qualified, even though he's been in the club. They know him. He's respected on both sides of the aisle because it's such a prominent position, because in general that position is held by somebody with some measure of experience in the community. I think you'll see a little bit of sharp questioning for Panetta, but he's a skilled hand and he'll certainly get through.
We are talking about current politics. Wake up call friends, Jim Sofka, Pete Ronayne here in the studio, 979-0919, 1-877 WNRN Rocks. And you can also send us a message on the computer. WNRN Studio is the AOL instant message address. Guys, I'm curious if I have my information right. New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson was appointed cabinet member for the Department of Commerce.
Yes.
Correct? And he had to step down or remove his name, and he did so willfully because of some background information. He's being looked into for a corruption charge or somehow involved with a corruption charge. How wasn't this determined and vetted out, as they say, before this even happened? I mean, this was a guy who was running for president.
I think that's one of the reasons why it probably fell through the cracks a bit. And it's still a bit of a mystery in terms of where this came from. There had been an investigation for sort of so-called pay-for-play politics, a much more muted version of what Governor Blagojevich in Illinois is being accused of. And it doesn't touch on Richardson as directly. It's more his connections with a fundraiser. And this particular fundraiser is alleged to have also given some money to Obama and other Democrats. And Richardson, it seems, when he was named Commerce Secretary, it's one of these curious cases where the degree of the investigation accelerated once he was nominated to the cabinet post. He probably should have disclosed it more aggressively earlier. The Obama people should have seen that what was probably a relatively minor investigation, a New Mexico-centered investigation, would blossom once he was actually named to a fairly high profile position in the Commerce Department. He'd also, by the way, been on the list for Secretary of State, for UN Ambassador, a job that he had previously held. So Richardson had been under consideration by Obama for a number of cabinet posts and, of course, had run for president. And I think it was a case where the Obama people, who had a lot on their plates, thought that Richardson was a safer pick. They put more of their energies to some of the other folks that President-elect Obama had nominated. And Richardson perhaps didn't see how this issue issue, which had been sort of a nuisance to him, would suddenly become much more so, or potentially more so, when he was asked to be Commerce Secretary. Even so, it's possible that this will all go nowhere, and he may be appointed to a position in the Obama administration somewhere down the road, if this actually goes away.
Yeah, I think, as Jim alluded to as well, that the timing with the Blagojevich scandal just raised the specter of this being even bigger than it is. It might be relatively innocuous. It is a little bit more distant from Richardson. However, the Obama team wanted no taint, nothing even being close to what's going on with Blagojevich. They should have caught it earlier. Mm-hmm. I think there's no doubt. And whether Richardson should have been more forthcoming about the nature of it, et cetera, it's hard to know. There have been a little bit of sort of passing the blame. But in terms of vetting people, I mean, it's important to note, you start with a 63-question questionnaire, then the FBI follows up with a much more in-depth investigation. Jim's right, any administration, there's a ton swirling around. And so that this fell through the cracks is both inexcusable and understandable, because there's so much happening. And I think Richardson, by all accounts, he seemed to reassure them that this would be wrapped up pretty much and moving towards closure in terms of his involvement. By the time confirmation rolls around, that clearly isn't going to happen. And there is no way the Senate would have confirmed him with this standing out there. And it is going to continue to be pending. So I think that helps to explain it. And now on the short list for Commerce, I mean, I haven't heard too much. I've heard Sebelius from Kansas and
Granholm from Michigan.
Yep. And possibly Laura Tyson from Berkeley, who was another Clinton economic advisor.
And that leads us to a question. By the way, Jim Sofka, Pete Ronayne here, local faculty at the Federal Executive Institute, and regular guests on the Wake Up Call when we're discussing politics. An instant message question, WNRN studio, or dial us up 979-0919. Obama nominates many Democrats, the cabinet positions. How does that affect us? And, you know, in my notes, Obama and Biden, two Democratic senators, correct? Add to that Clinton and Salazar, Hillary Clinton from New York, Salazar from Colorado. So there's four Senate seats. Is that correct? Salazar is a senator as well. And then there's House Representatives Rahm Emanuel from Illinois and Solis, or is that the proper pronunciation, or is it Solis, from California. And then there's two governors as well. And that's assuming that Bill Richardson has a step down as governor. So he may not. So that's at least one governor. So that's four senators, two House of Reps, and one governor, all Democratic positions that for the time being you would assume are replaced with Democrats through some method. But some of them have there'll be either a fill-in or they'll have a special election, I guess, is what I was looking for.
Right. They'll have special elections for representatives for the House, and the governors will appoint and have, I think, in almost not New York yet, but in other cases have appointed Democrats.
But there's no guarantee. Whenever the next election comes up, there's no guarantee that those seats will be filled by Democrats. And as we all know, an incumbent has a much greater chance of keeping that seat. So now you've taken all these seats away and put them up for. They're juggled as to who's going to get it, a Democrat or a Republican.
In almost all cases, the only case that's questionable would be the Arizona governorship, where the Republicans could make, I mean, Arizona now has John McCain, of course, from Arizona, two Republican senators, strong Republican party there. That's a question as to whether or not Napolitano's replacement would potentially face a challenge, very strong, significant Republican challenge. Other than that, most of these, if not all, are very safe Democratic seats. I mean, Emanuel's House seat in outside of Chicago, Solis' state district in California. I mean, the Delaware Senate seat, which Biden has held since 1972, is now there's a place sitter in there, his former chief of staff, because his son, Hunter Biden, who's now on the Army Reserve as a captain in Iraq, has basically been anointed to succeed him in a special election in 2010. So Biden knows all of these cases are going to be very safe for the Democrats. Of course, in a major firestorm year, if something were to come down, that was the economy gets worse, Obama becomes unpopular.
Like this year.
Yeah, but even more so in 2010.
Ago.
Yeah. if you could get, yeah, something like in 2006 or 2010, I mean, usually the president's party suffers some defeats in the House in the off-year elections. But these seats and governorships are very safe. And that's one of the reasons, of course, why Obama selected them. I mean, one of the reasons why he put Tim Kaine, governor of Virginia, as DN's chairman of the Democratic National Committee is because Kaine cannot succeed himself. And therefore, he's not going to jeopardize anything by taking him out of a sitting governorship. So that's one of the reasons why Obama's team carefully selected these folks, that it wouldn't jeopardize the balance of power.
Yeah. Salazar's seat in Colorado is probably the most threatened because Colorado is still, you know, is still split, but still fairly conservative. He beat Pete Kors in 2004, I think, and was sort of a red state upset. But he's being replaced by the Denver school superintendent.
That's right.
Who was pretty popular, who actually was on the short list for the federal Department of Education. But now Jim's right. They carefully think these things through and talk with Howard Dean at the DNC, et cetera. And so they're thinking certainly tactically about their own cabinet, but strategically about the party as well.
So they're not. So it sounds like what the two of you are saying is that if they determine that there are five quality candidates out there, that they may knock two of them off the list because it makes their seat, whether it's Senate, House, or governorship, more likely to be taken over by Republican or by the other party.
Oh, they may knock four out of five off for that reason, because if they wind up losing any one of those seats, then there's going to be hell to pay in terms of the Democratic National Committee as to why Obama jeopardized those seats, which the Democrats have fought heavily for, when you could have picked someone else who was at less at risk. I mean, in most of these jobs, don't forget, I mean, there's a lot of qualified people out there for most of these positions. It's very rare, if ever, that there's a truly indispensable individual who's the only person to fulfill these jobs. And everybody in politics knows this. This is part of the game. That if you're from a seat, if you're a sitting senator or a House member or a governor, and you know that you're the other party could potentially knock off your seat in another election, you realize that going in, that that's part of the weakness that you might have as a candidate for a federal appointment.
Is this some, I mean, it sounds almost like federal gerrymandering.
Well, I mean, it's both parties have broad interests that are beyond the White House. And so it doesn't mean somebody's disqualified, I think, but it is a factor, to be sure. I mean, the Salazar case is an interesting one when you think about the Department of Interior, the Democratic administration. Pretty much the Secretary of Interior is going to come from the West. I mean, that's almost a given because that's where most of the land and the resources, et cetera, that have to be managed are coming from. So you have to deal with mining industry. You have to deal with oil and gas industry. You have to deal with ranchers, et cetera. And that is very much heavily leans towards the West. All right. So you want somebody with credibility and experience and from the West, and you want a Democrat. So that's going to narrow the list a bit more, et cetera. So there are a lot of factors that are balanced. Then go through the potential vetting. You know, how is it going to fit into the broader cabinet? What's the relationship between that nominee and the president? I mean, a whole number of factors. So it has to be actually a thoughtful process. It's not necessarily gerrymandering, but it's, I think Jim's answer really suggested as well. It's very, very complex, actually. There's a lot that they have to factor in. It's easy to sit around and blog it and think, oh, it should be this person. Obviously, they're the most qualified, et cetera. But there are so many different levels that the president has to be thinking about and making sure that it's a safe and fairly non-controversial nominee. One thing I'll add about this is that the Obama team, picking up another lesson from the Clinton administration, has been extremely organized about this, yes, this transition and their cabinet. And they've received praise from both sides of the political aisle. The Clinton administration process in their first term was a disaster. I mean, it was reflective of Clinton and his personality. When his mind is racing all sorts of different ideas and lacking discipline, et cetera, it took them a long time to get these positions filled. Many more of them were controversial. Obama's team has been very diligent, very organized, announcing them in these clusters, sort of teams, thematic teams, keeping any one individual out of the full brunt of the spotlight, and basically having almost, I mean, with sort of the Richardson exception now, and that wasn't expected, you know, the main cabinet announced and technically in place by Christmas and certainly by the new year. Now, that is a marked contrast with the Clinton administration. I think in addition to its composition, the process, the professionalism, et cetera, has also been an attempt to convey a tone of smooth transition, of competence, of not being a massive change person that's going to upset things, of seriousness. And add on to that, the Bush administration has been remarkably cooperative, professional as well in this transition, especially in the field of national security. So it's about signaling to the public a confidence. And it's a very fine line to walk with a president departing, and you're still the president-elect, and President-elect Obama's had to toe that line. And he's been pretty clear along the way that there is only one president. There's always just one president. I'm not that yet. Yet also talking about his plans, his stimulus package, recognizing and respecting that he's not in that office yet. So it's there's rush to anoint him, and he's not there yet. I mean, it's not done. So
he's just getting the power turned on at the new house.
Well, he's getting the utilities put in his name and all that, but he's not moving in yet. So it's a good way to think about it.
All right, Jim Sofka and Pete Ronayne here as we talk about current politics. Feel free to dial us up to 979-0919. 1-877-WNRN-ROCKS. Although I passed these guys out a page and a half of material, we could talk until the 5 p.m. rock shift starts if we wanted to. Blagojevich, is that the proper pronunciation?
It is.
Blagojevich's name was mentioned in the last 5-10 minutes or so. Let's jump into that area. The Minnesota and the Illinois Senate seats are still unfilled. Minnesota, because of questions regarding the election itself and the very small number. Was it 325?
225 out of 3 million.
Right, 225 seats. So, as people should know, your vote does count.
It really does show that, whether it's local in terms of Pariello, Goode, whether it's this. I mean, it really does bear that out. Yep.
I mean, people talk about that. The Goode, Pariello vote was pretty close to that number difference, but that was for one district. The entire state of Minnesota. But Blagojevich has come under focus because of supposed offerings for sale of the Senate seat that Obama's inauguration will officially make open. Let's talk about that for a bit. How does his supposed behavior affect Obama before he ever gets into office? I mean, you've got his Senate seat was the one that is receiving the controversy, and Rahm Emanuel, which his official title now escapes me, in the Obama cabinet.
Chief of Staff.
His name has been mentioned with everything that's going on. So you guys take over.
I think in terms of the Blagojevich matter to Obama, it's more of a non-story. I mean, it's colorful. It's political theater. The governor himself, I mean, there's no need to recite everything that was in the allegations against him. But it's something that, you know, these things happen in politics. They tend to happen in Illinois more than other places, where two former governors are actually in prison as we speak. And possibly if, you know, Blagojevich will have his day in court, but it looks like the evidence against him that Mr. Fitzgerald's put together is pretty strong. It's really a non-story. It's a story in the sense that Obama's from Illinois, but Obama was never known to be close to Blagojevich. They didn't like each other. And actually, some of the tape recordings got Obama off the hook because the governor was ranting about Obama, bleeps everywhere about, you know, Obama not doing enough for him or supporting his political machine. So Obama himself really wasn't touched by it. Emanuel's involvement, of course, he's going to talk as a House member from outside of Chicago, is going to talk with the governor of Illinois. It'd be strange if he didn't. But no one's put forward any allegation of impropriety that Emanuel was doing anything wrong. Blagojevich was known to be politically sleazy for a long time, and Obama and his lieutenants kept their distance from him. And that's one of, and that's become very clear as things have gone on. The Burris matter of his replacement, though, is a complete, it's a non-story, and it's a story that only developed because I think that the Democratic Senate leadership, Harry Reid in particular, really got off to the wrong foot on this. They screwed this up. In Blagojevich, while he is governor of Illinois, has the right to nominate a Senate seat. Obama actually vacated his seat on November the 20th. He resigned right after he was elected. And President Clinton, when he was impeached in 1999, continued to make presidential appointments. He made ambassadorial appointments. That's his power.
He's still the governor. Clinton was still the president.
That's right.
You're accused. You haven't been convicted of anything. And Jim's exactly right. Harry Reid and others they should have thought this through a lot more in advance and recognized that structurally, in terms of power, the governor can still appoint the replacement. It might be distasteful. It might make you make your skin crawl. However, legally, that's still the deal. And unless you have some mechanism within Illinois for removing the governor before he makes that appointment, which they don't have, short of impeachment, but that's going to take the indictment. That's going to take some time. That's his right. And to not expect Blagojevich, given who he is and given his approach and given his attitude, to expect him not to appoint this, to be surprised by this, is so politically naive. It's remarkable. It doesn't surprise me then that Harry Reid was bent over three ways sideways by the Bush administration for years. I mean, come on, man. What do you think they're going to do?
Well, you talk about Harry Reid getting off on the wrong foot. I think for people who don't watch the news on a regular basis, when you say that, that's because he came out and was seen on television talking how bad this was, how we shouldn't do this, how Burris was a man that they would have nothing to do with.
I love the sudden moral rectitude
right.
of the
and
Senate.
Then,
all of a sudden, this is the moral issue of the day.
Within 24 hours, he comes back and says, I met him, he's a great guy, we'd love to have him. And so when you see someone do that, you lose all faith in this anything this person is saying.
Yeah, from a political strategy point of view, the average house cat could have played this better. As Pete said, you could have seen this coming. Blagojevich has the right to name a successor. And the Democrats, all Democrats, don't want there to be a special election in Illinois to replace Obama, because the Republicans could win that election, especially with Blagojevich now so unpopular. So it's this double game. They want that Senate seat to be safely Democratic, but they didn't want to be seen as going along with Blagojevich's creature. But Burris really has, I'm not an expert in Illinois politics, but from everything that I've read, Burris had no real connection to Blagojevich. He's a long-standing political figure in Illinois, reaching sort of the end of his career. He didn't have any involvement with the governor's machine or any of these allegations. No one's put that forward. And so instead of just simply saying, well, we don't like Blagojevich, but he has the right to name somebody, and then Burris would sort of fade into obscurity in the Senate itself, was the way to play it. But I think what happened is that they assumed Blagojevich was going to resign. They thought he was going to be gone. They would have made their great moral imperative case, as Pete said, standing up as this is the great issue, and then there would be someone else to deal with. And it just shows what happens when you get far ahead of yourself in politics. And Reid, it's true. Reid has been criticized time and time again for making very bold pronouncements and then having to backpedal on them. And, you know, this is not – he doesn't run the Senate the way LBJ did at his prime in the late 1950s. That's for sure.
Yeah. And the Obama camp has weighed in, president-elect himself saying, seat, Burris, let's move beyond this. It's like Jim said, this is political theater. It's a freak show. It's embarrassing to Illinois, frankly. I mean, I think the Illinois legislature wants to be strong, hence the 114-1 vote to impeach, to just put this behind them. The Obama camp wants that as well, because they are trying to change the tone. They're trying to change the image of politics. This is relatively distant from them, but it captures so much attention and coverage that it's a needless distraction. And Jim's right. If Harry Reid and the Senate and others wanted to deal with this, you seat Burris, let him be the senator, and then come re-election time, put all of your money, put DNC dollars, put all sorts of support behind someone to challenge him for the Democratic nomination for the seat, and get rid of him that way. There is a process for it. That's what they should be doing.
That's right.
All right, 11:43 here on the Wake Up Call with friends of the show, Pete Ronayne, Jim Sofka, both faculty members at the Federal Executive Institute, sharing their much-earned knowledge with people from the Washington, D.C. area as they come down and learn more and more. Let me do this.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
41 years after a double homicide in Stanton, police have at last made an arrest. But the man who solved the case says the arrest should have happened long ago and believes he discovered a cover-up. Former Charlottesville City Councilor Rob Schilling is a radio personality who recently lost his job. Now his fans are fighting to bring him back. and a writer discusses her own family's Depression-era experiences to show that hard times can bring out the best in us. The Hook. Use those other newspapers to start your fireplace fires. And 45fix.com is here helping us out today. If you have a home improvement project, there's another way to find a contractor. It's 45fix.com. From remodeling to repair projects, immediate, no obligation estimates are available anytime. That's 45fix.com, the number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. All right, back in action with Pete Ronayne and Jim Sofka.
We were talking about the Blagojevich scandal, which I think Pete and I agree is really a tempest in a teapot when you look at national politics, and it was, and really is a story that shouldn't have happened. You were alluding to the Minnesota Senate case. Now, this could get very interesting, and constitutionally as well as politically, because there's precedent in the past for the Senate to remand a senator back to a state if they don't want to seat someone. It's the same case, actually, that came up with Burris. The Article 1 of the Constitution gives the House and the Senate the right to choose their own members. In 1976, there was a Senate race in New Hampshire that was decided by 4 votes. You took 225 out of 3 million is pretty close. 4 votes. And the Senate would not seat that senator, who was duly certified by New Hampshire, on the grounds that it was simply too close, and it had to go back to a special election. In the case of the Frank and Coleman debate, I think that that's what a lot of people in the Senate want to do. They want to send it back to Minnesota. They're concerned about how this is going to be seen if they seat one or the other.
Right.
The problem is what happens in Minnesota politics, because the Republicans figure I probably have the most to gain by a new election. The Democrats do not, because they believe that the momentum was in their favor, and it's just like the case that we've been talking about with these safe seats there with Franken now, the technical victor. He's ahead, even if it's narrow. Why would you potentially want to jeopardize that by a new election?
And why would you send him back if they've had multiple recounts? And I mean, am I wrong? They had multiple recounts, and the official signing of the winner, and really the only thing that's holding him back is now it's gone to court because Coleman, the determined loser after all the recounts, says, wait a minute, let's take this to court.
Well, what's happened, the reason why, I mean, again, getting into the vagaries of Minnesota politics, there were some issues with particular bundles of votes, especially in Minneapolis, that raised a lot of questions. This isn't to say that Coleman's going to win his case or should win his case. There's enough, especially with an election that close. Look at what we saw in Florida in 2000, where, you know, really any fights over these ballots become major because anyone can swing it. With 225, it doesn't take much. You throw out a bundle of ballots from a particular polling station, that can change the election. The Republicans feel that they, by pushing this, that they can whittle that down and at least make it enough of an open question.
Yeah, and it is a small number. We're talking in general about 654 absentee ballots,
right,
in particular that are in question for whether they were properly rejected or not. Some of this comes down to handwriting analysis, that the signature on the ballot looks different than the handwriting on the envelope, et cetera. I mean, there are legitimate questions, and I think, Rick, you kind of hinted at this, Coleman has a tightrope walk of his own now. We all remember back in the Gore-Bush days, the sore loserman bumper stickers, et cetera. I mean, how far do you go? You want elections to be fair. You want them to be legitimate, et cetera, as much as possible. And there becomes a tipping point in which you can damage your own image and credibility. Coleman, his name has been floated out as possible the RNC chairman, et cetera. But if you push this stuff too far, you're too much of sort of the bitter hanger-oner guy, you could put your own future at risk. And you're talking about lots of documentation, too. I mean, even though it's just a few counties that favor Republicans, local officials are saying they're talking about requesting 30,000, 40,000 pages of related documents. Well, a 3-judge panel is going to take some time to sift through that. But Jim's right. The Democrats now in the Senate don't want to appear to be sort of hypocrites or contradict themselves where, oh, yeah, you're willing to seat Franken in this case, but you're not willing to seat Burris. So they're trying to square that one up.
All right. You got Gary on the line. Hey, Gary.
Hey, good morning. I haven't heard the whole show today, but I had a question for your guests regarding Obama's stimulus package. I was glad to finally see yesterday in the news that they've got some details on it, but I have yet to hear in any of the news media as to where the money is coming from to pay for all of this. And I'll just hang up and listen.
Well, that's the big question in terms of where the money's coming from. And it's going to come by federal borrowing. Essentially, what the stimulus package is going to come from is federal debt. And the assumption being that this stimulus package, like war debt, for example, in the Second World War and Korea, and by the way, the total package of this would be larger than what's been spent on the Iraq War, what was spent on the Vietnam War, that this would be basically financed by deficit spending, that is a government credit card, if you will, and that the economy, if it begins to increase as the president-elect, as we all hope it's going to, future tax receipts, particularly business commercial tax receipts, will defray that cost. So basically, it's dumping money in and hoping you'll get the revenue back and increase taxes later on, much in the way that in local government you would see spending on bonds, hoping to improve a community that would then become wealthier, and then property taxes would defray those costs. The two questions are, number one, this is going to completely balloon the federal deficit to record levels, and this is something that's been debated by a lot of economists as to whether or not it's good. And the second question is, what if it doesn't work, or what if it doesn't work the way it's intended in the short term? When are you going to have to start increasing taxes to pay for at least the interest on this debt, so that the United States doesn't default? The U.S. has never defaulted on a debt obligation ever since the Revolutionary War. And the last thing that what most economists agree would be disastrous is if the United States can't afford to pay interest on this spending, and therefore the package has to be carefully crafted. It's one of the reasons why the president-elect has talked about these shovel-ready projects. You want to put that money to things that will pay dividends almost immediately in order to get the tax revenue back as quickly as possible.
Right. That's why they're talking about spending it on infrastructure projects, bridges, roads, et cetera, green technology, tax cuts and incentives, as Jim mentioned earlier. But right, to answer the caller's question, as Jim did, it's a borrow-and-spend program, a targeted one with specific goals in mind. But that's a bipartisan approach. We are a borrow-and-spend country, whether you're financing the Iraq War or you're financing a stimulus package. Borrow-and-spend is very bipartisan in its nature.
Yeah, and as Dick Cheney said, Ronald Reagan showed that deficits don't matter. You know, so that question is whether or not deficits – the Clinton people worried about the deficit. They paid it down. They saw the deficit as a major issue. Obama does as well, but this is going to create a record amount of debt that's got a lot of people, you know, sucking in a lot of breath over the amount of what the stimulus is going to cost and when the returns will be seen, if ever.
Gary, thanks for the good call. And if you haven't heard the whole show, www.sevillepodcast.com. Check it out.
It's even better as a leftover, kind of like Thanksgiving.
You're such a bad man. Pete Ronayne, Jim Sofka here to talk about current politics on this week's Wake Up Call. Let me thank Alt Energy for their support today. They are designing and installing solar energy systems in Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Alt Energy solar systems now practical and reliable and can pay for themselves in a few years while reducing your carbon footprint. You can also make a difference by having kids turn off the lights when they leave a room and driving only when necessary and speeding down. Turn your speed down when you do that. And don't go anywhere as though you would, because at noon, Drew Thompson is here for Les Temps Purdue. Just walked in the door. Best of 80s and 90s alternative, no Styx or Huey Lewis or Rick James, but you will hear R.E.M., Superdrag, and Depeche Mode. And requests always welcome. Les Temps Purdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music. All right, back to Jim and Peter. Hey, we were talking a little bit about the Minnesota and the Illinois Senate seats. And to add Gary's question and sort of tie it all together, not having two Democratic senators for now, how does that affect proposals and votes?
Well, the Democrats continue to have a majority in the Senate, but with the magic number, which they wouldn't have even if Franken is seated, is 60. That's the supermajority. At 60, you're able to block filibusters from the other party, which are attempts to basically stonewall legislation you don't like by talking it to death. What the Democrats really hoped in November was that they would get 60. They don't. Even if everything goes the way everyone hopes, that Burris is seated from Illinois, Franken is seated from Minnesota, and of course the New York senator, the junior senator position that Hillary Clinton will vacate to become Secretary of State, which if she's confirmed, which I assume she will be safely Democratic. So in terms of Obama's overall legislative approach, whether or not Franken is in the Senate or not, or Burris, take them out, isn't really going to matter much. He's got the majority. But of course, the Senate's an interesting place. Just because it's the Democrats have a majority, there are Democrats, you know, fairly more conservative Democrats who may see things more in line with liberal Republicans, like, for example, Olympia Snowe of Maine. So things in the Senate are not as partisan in the House because the Senate has a six-year term. It was purposely designed to be more immune from partisan pressures. So for Obama, these two issues are sideshows to his broader political objective. I mean, what the Democrats would hope is that they'd be able to pick up in 2010 enough seats to get him over 60. That could happen because there's a number of retirements coming up. Just on Friday, Kit Bond of Missouri announced that he's not going to seek re-election. He's a Republican. He was the youngest governor in Missouri history and now a fairly senior senator. That's a seat that the Democrats could potentially pick up in 2010. But right now, these matters are much less relevant to Obama than crafting and selling this package to the American people in a way that people are ready to take on this debt and build a package that, to use his slogan, we can believe in.
Yeah, with a majority at 57 or so, lacking a couple of seats makes it marginally more difficult. But Obama, you know, as senator coming from that body, has cultivated relationships on both sides of the aisle. His success is going to be predicated really on it being bipartisan. I mean, it sounds like a mantra and sounds like sort of, you know, political sound bites, but it's true. He's going to need support on both sides because, look, the end of this week, his stimulus plan came under fire and criticism from within his own party, which reminds us that, in particular, Democrats are notoriously difficult to keep in line. They're much more willing to jump ship and far less disciplined in general than Republicans are, particularly in the House, but in both bodies. So he's got work to do on both sides of the aisle, particularly trying to present himself as bipartisan and, like we talked about before, upsetting liberals within his own party.
Yeah, the House is going to be the big fight for Obama because he has a very different tone and political approach than Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker. And there has already been, as Pete alluded to, a lot of Democrats who have screamed about this idea of corporate or individual tax relief. They would like to see taxes go up. Pelosi said as much publicly. Obama has tried to avoid that lightning rod because he wants to build centrist and some Republican support, whereas the House feels now that we've got Obama in the White House, he's in essence going to be our creature. He's going to pursue that more liberal agenda, which is where we began our hour, is talking about Obama's relations with his own party, which I think at least for the next 2 years, to the 2010 elections, are going to be his major challenge, not the Republicans.
All right, you are listening to WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. Another instant message question that came in. Stimulus package is about the jobs. What about the houses? So when Obama ran, obviously there was a lot of going on about foreclosures. And I think many people, while they want the jobs and if they want it and they're concerned about their neighbors, et cetera, if you still have your job, but you can't pay for your house, what's going to be done about that?
Yeah, there are several proposals. I was just reading about this before we came in. Obama, you know, reaching back to Lincoln. We know that he's big into that, but he's reaching back to the New Deal as well and talking about reviving a Depression era organization, the Homeowners Loan Corporation, which is a federal entity, and it would buy distressed mortgages from the banks. And that would take off some pressure as well. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, is floating a proposal to help consumers, homeowners, to restructure well over 2 million mortgages so that payments on those mortgages would be reduced to below or around 30% of the holder's gross pay.
How long before that happens?
How long before that could happen?
We've got about 90 seconds left.
How long could that happen?
I mean, theoretically, it could be done almost by the middle of February, which is now what they're looking at to have this whole package put together. But it's very controversial because other Democrats like Barney Frank have said, I want $40 billion of foreclosure relief.
And most that's a long time for somebody who's already behind 3 months on their house payment.
It's true. Government can only do so much, and we've had lots of conversations, the personal responsibility side of things as well. They can only move so quickly to make sure that it's legal and effective. But to the caller's question, the Homeowners Loan Corporation and this idea of restructuring mortgages and having the government cover the difference, at least in the short term. And it won't help everybody, but...
No, and it'd be late spring at the best case before people actually begin to see this in their wallets if, in fact, it passes the way that everyone wants.
All right, guys, thanks so much. Quick comment before we go. Pete, you had your mouth open. Or were you munching?
Well, I was just saying it's systemic. So to help people pay for their houses, you have to help people pay for health care. So that has to come along as well.
That's right. It's all of a package. And that's going to be where the devil's in those details.
All right. Pete Ronayne, Jim Sofka, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thanks, Rick.
Our pleasure. Thanks.
As usual, we'll have you back on pretty soon because politics never goes away. Drew Thompson up next. Les Thames Perdue, give him a call. Make a request.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@AOL.com or at wakeupcall@WNRN.org. The wake-up call is produced by Sean McCord. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the wake-up call, only on WNRN.